On Christmas, we'll deal with the birth of Christ, but this is after. Often in nativity stories and renditions done in movies or plays or however, this event recorded in Matthew 2 is put together at the same time as Luke chapter 2, where he deals with the shepherds being announced the birth of Christ, who are in the fields at night tending the sheep, and then the angels come declare to them that the Savior is born, and they go to see the Savior. But biblically speaking, they're two separate events, and that's what we're going to focus on now. Now, this event in Matthew 2 happens approximately about 2 years after. We can't say that with 100% certainty, but there's some clues in the text itself that give us that indication, that belief, the reason to believe it to be that. Not necessarily all in our reading and study today, but a little bit later on when we get to the point where Herod does send his soldiers to kill all the children in Bethlehem, and the announcement is 2 years and younger. And I'll give you some other reasons as we move forward. But this bottom line is, taking some time after Jesus was born in Bethlehem. So let's start with verse 1. Now, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from east came to Jerusalem. Now, we will get to verse 9 and 11, where we will see that Christ is called the child. And I'll tell you a few things there, but before we just move any further, as another evidence that this is happening sometime later, is you find in the Greek, the word for child used in verses 9 and 11 is Greek word paideion, which literally means little child. It's not the same word that Luke uses when Christ is born in Luke chapter 2, verse 12, where the word is infant, and the word, Greek word is brephos. So they're coming to worship the king that's already been born, and it's of some age. Now, the mystery here happens around, well, two mysteries. First one is this verse 1, wise men from east. Who are they? This is one of those things that has captivated the imagination of so many people. Who are these wise men? And eventually, tradition developed in some part of the church, not all church, but in some parts of the church, that there were three wise men. And they were given traditional names. But there is no biblical reason to believe that there were only three of them. As actually we cover some of the things, it's more reasonable to believe there was actually more than three, even though they presented three gifts, and that's why some have assumed there was three wise men. But there's no textual indication there was only three of them. For example, tradition in Eastern Orthodox Church tells us that there were 12 of them. It could have been 300 of them. We don't know. What we do know is that they came from east. And east will mean east of Jerusalem, east of Israel. Many believe in the regions of Persia, regions of, you know, modern-day Iraq, Iran. Some think even further away. But few clues in the text tell us that they came from most likely regions of Iraq and Iran. Now, one of the fascinating things about these men is that we know that they are Gentiles. They're not Jews. They're not Jewish men that have come to worship. They're Gentiles. They're described, the word used here is magi, meaning that they were those who were studying the stars. Something for them to be astronomers, astrologers, it's uncertain. in many ways, they could be called scientists of their day. They studied the stars and then made decisions based upon that study. The use of magi's was a common thing in the ancient Near East. Kings would use them to be their counselors, the one who they would seek advice as what they should do, and then they would study the stars to see what's going to happen. Now, the mystery about these men lies in the fact that, well, are they astronomers, astrologists? Are they some kind of a magicians? Are they scientists? Who are they? What inspires them to come and worship Christ? And we'll see as we move further into text. But there is a mystery about them. It's a kind of fascinating thing when you think about it. Remember, who is writing this account? Matthew. Now Matthew, of all the Gospels, Matthew's Gospel is the most Jewish one, intended for Jewish audience. Yet he tells us something about these Gentile men that came to see Jesus. Now we are told that they did it in the time of Herod the king. Herod was also known as Herod the Great, best known of all Herods, rulers in Judea at that time, Roman-appointed rulers, not people-appointed rulers. He was descendant of Esau, so he was not a Jewish man. He was not, by any means, a rightful king over Israel. He was appointed king by Romans. Descendants of Esau, the Edomites, they were, well, the enemies of Israel. In our study to the Minor Prophets, for example, even in our last study in Malachi, we saw discussion about Edomites and descendants of Esau. But Herod the Great was a descendant from that. He was not Jewish. He converted to Judaism, probably for political reasons, to appease Jewish people, because obviously they didn't want to receive him, so he became Jewish, probably for political reasons. History tells us for almost 20-some years of his rule, he was a fairly good king. He did good things. He established great systems in Israel. He expanded the second temple that was rebuilt by the exiles who returned from Babylon. He invested in it so much that it became greater than it was Solomon's first temple built. So in many ways, he at first seemed like a decent king, even though he wasn't Jewish. But then in the last several years of his rule, that's when things started to change. He became known as the brutal, disgusting king. He was married 9 times. It was not a strange thing for him to kill his wives and his children because he feared that they were going to take over his rule. So it was a saying that it was better to become or to be Herod's pig than a family member because of his brutality towards his own family. He was not a good man. He was also a moral man in so many ways. And for some reason that we don't know for certain why, the religious leaders in Israel at that time, some supported him. You had a group among Jews who were called Herodians. They supported the rule of Herod's and thought that it was good for them to have Herod's as kings. You have zealots who did not, obviously. Then you had Sadducees and Pharisees, a very divided group of people. Among high priests was a Sadducee. It was a very interesting time. Herod was just known for his brutality and kind of a, well, superficial religiosity. He would do the things that people wanted him to do, what the priest asked him to do, but behind the scenes, obviously, he was corrupt. So, imagine this. By this time, Herod's been established on his throne for about 3 decades now. And last several years are known for his brutality towards his own family because he wanted to rule. as long as possible. And now, all of a sudden, this delegation shows up in Jerusalem. Now, this was obviously no secret. Because as we read in verse 2, when these men came to Jerusalem, they said, "Where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we have seen his star in the east and have come to worship him." So they came to Herod, these wise men, and because they assumed, well, they saw the star, we are told. The star was leading them towards Israel. And they reached Jerusalem. And their assumption is, well, the king should be in Jerusalem. That's where the capital is. People should be worshiping their king. Yet, as we will see later, that was a surprise to Herod and to many. How come there's a king that is born? But the mystery continues with the very fact that they said, "We have seen his star." So that's the clue to us. Now, the star has been that second mystery, the second intrigue. And many things and many books and many even documentaries have been made about this star. What is this star that they're referring to? Is it a literal star in the sky, in the night that we see? Is it a comet? Is it some other heavenly body or whatever it is? And there's, again, been some assumptions. Some have made some interesting assumptions in regards to this. The nice thing about studying astronomy, and in our modern day, you have software that you can reverse back and see where the moon was 352 days ago. Every body in heaven, you can kind of know where their position was related to where we are. But what's interesting about this is that it's called his star. So the question is there a star that really was meant to God in a creation has already appointed to be there and to appear at this particular time in history to declare the birth of Christ? That wouldn't be a wonder, because if you look at Daniel chapter 9, the prophecy of Daniel, the 70-week prophecy, has precisely predicted the time of Christ's triumphant entry into Jerusalem to the date. We can calculate that easily. So it's possible for God to do that, obviously. But there's also another possibility. There was just unique event, supernatural star, whatever it is. Something that God at this time put to draw attention of these men to start following. Now, why would they look for that star? That's, to me, fascinating part. Why would these men look for the star in the first place? These were Gentiles. How come these Gentiles, pagans, to use another word, were seeking the star for the king of the Jews, ultimately the Messiah? Well, there's been many guesses, and one of the most common assumptions that has been made about this is that they were influenced by Daniel. If you remember Daniel, he was a captive of Judah, taken into Babylon, and made to be a servant to the king Nebuchadnezzar. He was raised in the wisdom of Babylonians, taught the language and everything about, but he was one of four who decided to live uncompromising life for Christ, for God, in Babylon, but serve Babylonian king, nonetheless. And Daniel lived in Babylon, serving Nebuchadnezzar, later serving Belshazzar, later serving Darius, Persian king. But he was among the advisors to the king. He was surrounded by magi, astrologists, we're told, magicians, and all the other people who served these pagan kings as wise men. So many have assumed that Daniel was a man who, for so many years, lived in Babylon from his youth till his passing, that it's quite possible that he created at some order among these wise men that he informed them about Old Testament scriptures and got them to look towards the coming Messiah because there were prophecies. Daniel, we know, studied Old Testament prophecies, Jeremiah, for example, and so many other passages. So it's a possibility that Daniel had a role to play in these men's lives so many years later. That there was writings of Daniel that they studied. That maybe he left some kind of a message. Because remember, when you look at Daniel, even though these wise men who were pagans, many of them were irritated by Daniel and his success, clearly saw the wisdom that Daniel had that came from God. Over and over again, Daniel was able to predict future, interpret dreams that none of them were able to. So it's quite possible that there was some form of reverence towards the writings of Daniel that existed. We don't know. These are just assumptions. These are just some of those things that kind of leave us, well, what is it? What's going on here? But they did study the stars because they looked and they saw the star. And it was different in some way. It's possible that they were reading some of the passages like in Numbers 24, 17 to 18, where it tells us that there will be a star. So you can turn to Numbers. Remember, that's the prophecy of Balaam, another pagan, speaking about coming Messiah. It says, verse 17, I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come out of Jacob. A scepter shall rise out of Israel and batter the brow of Moab and destroy all the sons of tumult. And then it talks about Edom being possession and so forth. But the star shall come out. Some think that that is the reference to this. That maybe they were studying that and other things maybe that Daniel had revealed to them. I don't know. But it's interesting. When you look at Isaiah 60, verse 3, it says, the Gentiles shall come to your light and king to the brightness of your rising. This rising could also have a meaning of a star. So it's quite possible that they were just studying the Old Testament passages and were led to follow this star when it did appear in heavens. But let us not forget that it's no surprise that God would use the heavenly bodies for something like this. Remember in Genesis when God created the heavens? For what did He create them for? For signs, one of the things is described, and seasons. Again, so it's no wonder if God would have done that. Think of them in this way. They could have easily learned about the Messiah by studying the natural order around them. Just like scientists today can come to conclusion that God exists. Now you need particular revelation to know more about Him, but the general revelation can lead you in the right direction. As many scientists have been led to know God and to the Lord by simply studying science. They see the order, the complexity of life, and they come to logical, reasonable conclusion that there must be a great mind behind us, a great designer. Just like any program has a programmer, you look at the creation, you realize this is extremely, extremely complex piece of programming. So many things fall into place that for any reasonable person is like, well, it has to have a programmer behind it, somebody behind this. So all they did is they just, okay, we see this and they decide what? To come. To me, that is amazing. Why would these wise men leave the comfort of their home? The wealth probably that they had from the gifts they brought. And travel for quite a long ways. Remember, no modern travel means no cars, no planes, trains. There's just camels, deserts, and a caravan that does not travel fast. It could have taken months for them to cover this distance, depending where they left from. And they decided to go. They left everything to find the King of the Jews and what? To worship Him. To me, that's fascinating. Of all the nativity stories, you know, and all the accounts we have of the birth of Christ in Luke, also in Matthew, Mark, well, almost nothing in Mark. One of the things we find is that we see that when Jesus was born, it was declared to the shepherds. Shepherds came, they saw Him, and they declared to everyone around them. 8 days later, Joseph and Mary go to the temple to dedicate Him, being obedient to the law, because it was required that the firstborn be dedicated to the Lord and circumcised. And one of the things that they do, they go to the temple, and you have two people being revealed by God that they will see God's Messiah. But what's fascinating in these three groups of people, the shepherds, the prophetess Anna, and Simeon, they hear, well, the shepherds hear the message, they go and they're amazed and declare. And same as with Simeon and Anna, they declare praises to God. But it doesn't say anywhere that they worshipped Him. But these men came to worship Jesus. Gentiles. The first group of people that actually made a great effort to come to worship Christ. Showing, even to the gospel that was dedicated for the Jews, that Christ is not just Jewish Messiah, but Messiah for all the world. The Gentiles will come and worship Him. And in our study of minor prophets, we've seen many of these prophecies given. Same in Malachi. And it's true. These men being representatives of Gentiles truly represents what ends up happening. That the church that at first was just Jewish only turned into international church and most Gentiles coming to faith. And that's fascinating. Their whole journey, the whole purpose, even before they did it, was to come and worship. From the get-go, that was on their hearts, on their mind. That was their intent. It's a great lesson here. The only way of going after Christ is to come to worship. No other motive. They didn't come to Jesus to receive something. You remember when Solomon was renowned for his wisdom, and the word spread out throughout the surrounding countries. People would come to Jerusalem to listen to Solomon's wisdom, to receive advice and things of that sort. But these men are coming not to receive anything, but to give. To give worship. That's a great example. Let's get back to our text. In verse 3, we read now, when Herod, the king, heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. Of course he would be troubled. He was already troubled that somebody within his own family would rule instead of him. Now he all of a sudden has this massive entourage of people coming from far east. Again, this is not three people showing up. To have three people show up to Jerusalem wouldn't be a big deal. But all Jerusalem was troubled. That means it was a big group. Here they are, uninvited. Probably a very large number of people traveling. Because obviously travel back then wasn't safe. And carrying this much wealth, and they would stick out with all that. They needed protection. They needed people accommodating all their needs. It's quite possible hundreds of people came. So this massive entourage shows up in Jerusalem, and everybody's like, who are these guys? Did they came to see Herod? No, they came to see the newborn king. So Herod hears this, and he's troubled, understandably so. And it's true even today that so many people are troubled by Jesus, aren't they? The very mention of Christ troubles them. Just like here, the very mention, there's a king. Well, wait a minute, there's someone else? So Herod is troubled, and we read in verse 4, and when he had gathered all the chief priests and scribes of the people together, he inquired of them where the Christ was to be born. So they said to him, in Bethlehem of Judea, for thus it is written by the prophets, but you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are not the least among the rulers of Judah. For out of you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. Now this is a quote from Micah 5:2. We studied that in our study in Minor Prophets, so I'm not going to talk much about this, except what's kind of interesting in narrative here. Herod is troubled. He calls for chief priests. It sometimes passes. These men are hosted by Herod. They're waiting. He calls for the rulers, and they all come, and they are aware that this group is there. So it's not just Herod who knows about this. The chief priests, the scribes, all they are aware this group is here. They've come to see the newborn king. So Herod, you know, asked them, where is he to be born? And obviously they quote the biblical reference in Bethlehem. Bethlehem was, well, close. Very close to Jerusalem. But important thing to see here is that the Old Testament points to Christ. And that's not a surprise to us, but it is, again, important to be reminded. Over 300 prophecies in the Old Testament that deal only with the first coming. There's others that deal with the second coming. And we discussed in the past the mathematical likelihood of somebody fulfilling all these prophecies. Even 8 of them is high in probability. But when you consider 300 prophecies fulfilled to the letter, in one person, that's impossible. The odds are against it by it happening, for that happening by accident, unless it is divinely appointed, as obviously was. His birth, where he was going to be growing up, parts of his ministry, the way he's going to die, a lot of things that an individual cannot control himself, unless he was God. If Jesus was not God, he could not orchestrate this. If God was not behind this, it just couldn't happen. No human being in history has met any of these fulfillments found in the Old Testament in regards to the first coming but Christ. No other human being in history or present can claim that they have fulfilled these things except Christ. And at the very beginning, it signifies that he is the fulfillment of the Old Testament. So the Old Testament scripture points to Christ. Just like history points to him. We discussed this in the past. New Testament is a reliable historical document. Historians treat it that way. History points to him. It's not a myth or a legend or a fictional character, but a real person in history that showed up about 2,000 years ago. Born in Bethlehem. Spent first couple of years in Bethlehem. Eventually he would spend some time in Egypt, and after that some time in Nazareth. But also, another thing that confirms Christ, obviously, is logic, reason. When you look at these fulfillment of prophecies, and that history confirms that he was a real person and the New Testament accounts are accurate, it only makes logical sense to believe him to be who he claimed to be. It's illogical to assume for him to be anything else. I've quoted this before, and I love quoting it because it's such a, well, it's a good quote. C.S. Lewis put it so well. You know, so many people today say, well, he was a good teacher. He was a nice man. And this is what C.S. Lewis said in regards when you consider historical accounts, when you consider fulfillment of prophecy, when you consider what Jesus said and did. This is what he tells. I'm trying here to prevent anyone saying the really foolish thing that people often say about him. I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God. That is the one thing we must not say. A man who was merely a man and said the sort of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He will either be a lunatic on a level with the man who says he is a poached egg, or else he would be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool, you can spit at him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He has not left it open to us. He did not intend to. Now, I don't think anyone can say it better than that. Then we see Herod, after hearing this prophecy, verse 7, when he had secretly called the wise men, determined from them what time the star appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem and said, go and search carefully for the young child. And when you have found him, bring back word to me, that I may come and worship him also. Now notice what's interesting in this part. He secretly called him. Well, in most, you know, movies, plays, you often see them all eating with Herod, and it seems like it's only them and Herod. So there will be nothing secretive if he was just to talk to them. What was probably going on here is that there was a great feast, the religious leaders were there, everybody's there, and Herod secretly takes the wise men aside. And he tells them, so when did you see the star? Because remember, everybody's troubled. The wise men still don't know much about Christ. They have not seen him yet, except that they know he was born. The religious leaders are now wondering, wait a minute, how did we miss this? Herod is now concerned somebody's going to take his throne. He's probably thinking he's already adult in some case. Or, as he says here, young child. And he says, well, find him. Because they told him, well, it's probably, as we will see, maybe 2 years ago, or we don't know the time, but not too much. And goes, okay, he's a young child. So he's plotting. Already has a plan in mind. And that plan is, well, I'll send him so that the parents wouldn't be disturbed by the fact that the soldiers and Herod is coming, because everybody knows that Herod is good at killing anyone who sees a threat. Him sees a threat. And so his plan is, I'll send these guys. They'll come, they'll find him, and they'll tell it to me, and then I'll kill him. That's his plan. You see, he masks this with the words, so that I may come and worship him also. He knows that these guys are going to worship, so he's going to pretend that he's going to worship. And there's a lot of people today who are pretend worshipers, who are in the church, who raise their hands, not because they truly want to worship Jesus, they just are in the environment of others who do that. They have their reasons, their motives for doing that, but they're motive is not to worship Christ. They're just pretenders. And sometimes we can easily be tricked by them. Sometimes you think, oh, this person loves God. Well, they say the right things, they do the right things, they do the right motions, they sing the same songs. And then, sometime later, it's not that they just don't want anything to do with you, it seems like they're your enemy. They're like Herod in that sense. So, he has his plan, they have their plan. So when they heard the king, verse 9, they departed, and behold, the star which they had seen in the east went before them till it came and stood over where the young child was. And I love verse 10. When they saw the star, they rejoiced with exceedingly great joy. Now, this gives us a hint, this verse 9 first. The star, it appears so that once they started a journey and were directed in the direction they should go, it disappeared. So they walked in faith, traveled in faith in a sense to Jerusalem. And once they're done with Herod, it appears to them, again, that the text seems to indicate that it appeared again and led them to Bethlehem. Now, Herod knew that the child was to be born in Bethlehem, but he didn't know for certain that the child was in Bethlehem. The star led these wise men to Bethlehem. And again, just the very fact that it will appear and lead them indicates a supernatural thing going on here. The likelihood of some kind of a heavenly body that was there, you know, from the beginning of creation guiding them is, I think, less likely to be the answer as it is some supernatural intervention of God. But notice, as they saw the star and guiding them towards the child, they rejoiced with exceeding great joy. This is even before they came to worship. They didn't even see him yet. They didn't even bow down before him yet. They were already rejoicing. That reminds me of that psalm that says, you know, that going to worship the God with song and rejoicing for the fact that the psalmist is going to go into the temple to worship the Lord. What a great example of coming to worship God. Sometimes, you know, we feel, well, we just don't want to be in a church building on Sunday or whatever, or gathering with other believers. What a powerful exhortation to rejoice even before we start worship, because you know you will worship, because you know you're going to meet with the King. They were seeking after Jesus and they were now so close. They never met him. They never saw him. All they had was a star guiding them and probably some Old Testament prophecies. And that was enough to give them joy of knowing that they're going to see the Messiah. What a step of faith is demonstrated by these men. Part of their journey on blind. No star to guide them. Until now. They didn't see the star for a while, and now they see it and they're rejoicing because they're so close. They rejoice with exceedingly great joy. That it means exactly what it says. Exceedingly. Rejoicing with exceedingly great joy. It's like saying, you're happy, so happy that you cannot even describe how happy you are. Everything about their journey, everything about the difficulty of their travel was put to nothing with this fact that they're going to see the King. Do we have that attitude? We know we're going to meet with the King. Do we have joy? Do you wake up in the morning before your devotions with joy or with grumbling? To get up another day. Sometimes even we can look at the passing, a death, as, well, in many ways it's a mysterious thing, but in many ways it's not. Some people look at it fearful things, afraid to die. But a believer should rejoice. Now, don't get me wrong, we shouldn't look for death. But, at the same time, we should look forward to meeting the King. There is joy in knowing that those who pass are in the Lord's presence. Now, verse 11. And when they had come into the house, they saw the young child with Mary his mother and fell down and worshipped him. And when they had opened the treasures, they presented gifts to him, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Now, notice how often the word worship appears in these verses. It's clear that their intent was to worship him. That was their plan, and when they got to see him, they worshipped him. They didn't change their mind. Remember, Jesus was born not into a wealthy family. Maybe they expected to find him in Jerusalem in the court of a king. But when they found out and nobody knew about it, they were like, okay, that's different. So they traveled to Bethlehem, a village, insignificant village in many ways. And they just find him in a house. Now, he was born in a manger, but by this point they live in a house. And notice how it's described. When they saw the young child with Mary, his mother. You see, this is grammatically incorrect, culturally incorrect. It should say, Mary, his mother, and the young child. But this child was different. This child was special, unique. He gets preeminence. He is the one who is more important. They came to worship the child, not Mary, and that's important. Too many people worship Mary today, and she was just a common woman, given an amazing gift, privilege, like no other woman ever got. But she was just a woman, nothing else. They came to see the Christ child. And they bowed down and they worshipped him. And it didn't stop there. They brought some gifts. Gold, symbol of deity, glory, kingship, wealth. They gave him gold. One of those most valuable things somebody could give to somebody at that time, they gave. Frankincense, it's an ointment or perfume which was used by priests. And then myrrh, which is a spice used in burials often, which has caused many to see the interesting prophecy, maybe unwillingly, done by them, that when they give gold, they spoke about his kingship. When they gave him frankincense, they talked prophetically about his priestly service that he will do, and then myrrh about his prophetic ministry, and like many prophets that have gone before him, he would be a killed prophet, murdered prophet. And it's true. Biblically speaking, most prophets were killed. So you do see the king, the priest, and the prophet all fulfilled in Christ. And then we see in verse 12 how they were divinely warned in a dream that they should not return to Herod. They departed to their own country another way. So, you know, things here for us to think about. There's more going on here than just these men coming. I mean, Again, think about this. These were Gentiles, pagans, most likely. Moves to seek after Christ. And they made it a costly thing. It cost them something. It cost them their time. I mean, it was a big endeavor to take such a journey back then. Especially if you carried wealth. You were targeted. It could have cost them their life. It cost them their wealth. Things that they had, they brought to Christ. They came to worship Him. That was their motive. Their motive to seek out Jesus was not selfish. There was no self-interest. What can I get out of Christ? But rather, what can I give to Christ? We're traveling to worship. And as we go to worship, guess what? We'll worship with our lives. We're going to worship with the things we have. You know, so many times today, I fear that so many of us have this attitude. What can I get out of Christ? What can I get out of church? What can I get out of fellowship instead of what can I give? They bowed down before the child. They were not like, oh, he's a baby, young child, a toddler, whatever. They didn't care. They got to see the Messiah. I think, you know, all their travels, all the hardships that probably went into it, was worth it the moment they saw him. That was the reward that they wanted. Just like Anna, when Jesus was brought into the temple. Just like Simeon, when Jesus was brought into the temple. They got to see the Messiah, a hope of Israel. You know, and it's kind of interesting reflecting on this time is that Christ was born, He lived for a while, already present, not far from Jerusalem. And the nation that was supposed to be excited about the birth of Messiah could care less about it. It was the Gentiles who made the costly trip to find Him. And you look at all the people mentioned in this narrative. They're perfect representation of the world today and how people react to Christ. Some are like Herod, desiring to get rid of Him. They have problem with Christ, they have problem with Christians. They're troubled by us, troubled by those who want to worship Jesus. They want to silence them, they want to prevent them, they want to get rid of Christ. Some are like the priests, who seem to be completely indifferent. I mean, wouldn't they be excited that the Messiah is here? Well, when we read the Gospels, when Jesus is doing His ministry, we see why they were not so excited. They themselves were not right with God. They themselves wanted power. People of Jerusalem were troubled. So you have religious group indifferent, people as a whole indifferent, and then you had those who worship Him. And it's interesting, they're called wise men. And I submit they're wise men because they came to worship Christ. They came to give everything to seek after Christ. And that's just my encouragement for us. To be wise, men and women, who seek after Jesus every day, with our whole life. You know, for some people, they seek Christ only at Christmas time and Easter. They seek Christ when they're in trouble. And that's it. But wise are the ones who seek after Him, who make a sacrifice, daily sacrifice, to leave everything for Him. And I know for you here, that's the case. And for those who are not here but couldn't be here, some of them, that's the case. But it's an encouragement to remain wise by seeking after Him every day of your life. And if you do that, I promise you this, most people will not understand you. They'll look at you and think you're foolish. They think you're wasting time. I guarantee you will have trouble with some of your family members. They just won't get it. They won't understand your passion for Jesus, your passion for His Word. That when you look open the Scriptures, you see Jesus in every page because He is there. It points to Him. The Old Testament points towards Him and the New Testament reflects on everything He has done and is doing. They will look at you and go, "You're strange." Some maybe will just follow along pretending for a while because their hearts are not in the right place. They don't care about Christ. They have a different motive. Don't come to Him with your motives. Come to worship Him because He is worthy of all praise and glory and honor. That's just an encouragement to be wise by seeking Him. You know, not because this is the season, because seeking Christ is in season 365 days a year, or 366 days a year when it's a leap year. Your whole life. So when one day we'll be like the wise men, we'll actually get to see Him face to face. We'll bow down and worship Him. Because that's the whole point, right? If you have a hard time worshiping Christ now and rejoicing in the prospect of worshiping Him, what are you going to do in eternity? Because that's all it's going to be about. And again, reflecting just on the fact that, you know, Pastor Quinn, Lord took him at his time of when he would have his devotions. How appropriate. Something he looked forward to every day, he got to do. Yeah. And just like wise men, you won't see them until we're in the kingdom. Same with Him. We'll see Him. And He just got a blessing of worshiping Him longer than we get to. So He has it far better than we do. Let's pray.